Two murders in Israel. One, a 14-year-old Israeli girl. The other, a 14-year-old Palestinian boy. Both part of the persistent buzz of violence in a society of oppression and conflict.
I think violence is that kind of, that buzz, always there till it becomes a constant, a given, and in that way, almost invisible. And the both of those deaths actually started as a kind of background brutality that characterizes the novel and in my observations, the region. And it was really only as I began, I guess, pushing myself to write whatever I found the most frightening to write, that I began to deal more and more directly with these deaths and with the people who were affected by these deaths, and in some cases had participated in them.
That's Rebecca Sachs. We talk with her about her powerful debut novel, City of a Thousand Gates. It's about the intersecting stories of the peoples of Israel and Palestine and how oppression twists and informs the humanity of perpetrators and victims. Then we replay our 2016 interview with Palestinian-American novelist Susan Abulhawa about her second novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Rebecca Sachs' searing and powerfully written debut novel, City of a Thousand Gates, interweaves the stories of a cast of characters, Palestinians, Israelis, and observers, in Israel and the occupied West Bank. It's a place where violence is routine and survival is defined by boundaries, walls, and checkpoints that force people to live and love within and across them. The novel revolves around two interconnected and defining events, the murders of two teens. One is Yael, an Israeli settler murdered in her bed at night. Soon after, a revenge killing of Salem, a Palestinian teenager who's beaten to death by a gang of Israeli men at a mall. Vera, a German journalist, is witness to the impact of the murders on the society and people around her. Rebecca Sachs fully enters into the personalities of her characters, never shrinking from the moral challenges of a society where injustice and privilege play out. Rebecca Sachs has received several writing awards and is a citizen of Canada, the United States, and Israel. Her dispatches from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem have been published in journals such as the Paris Review Daily. Rebecca Sachs, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
This novel, City of a Thousand Gates, is a searing exploration of life across the Israeli-Palestinian divide through the intersecting lives of a range of characters, 32 in all, with 19 of them having a voice. First, I just want to ask you, how were you able, as a non-Israeli, non-Palestinian, to get this so right?
Thank you. I should say that although I went to Israel initially as someone who wasn't Israeli and didn't speak Hebrew, I did eventually take citizenship, which is very easy if you have Jewish heritage, and essentially impossible if you do not. But still, I'll always be an outsider there. And that does have its advantages, I think, if you're going to write about a place, to have access and yet also to not be eligible for a full sense of belonging. But in terms of how I wrote characters very far outside of myself, for me, I think it started almost always deep inside the character. I had to find an entry point with each character, maybe something we shared, and go from there. And by go from there, I mean go deep into this other character and leave myself behind. but it did need for me to start with an entry point into the interior life of the character. What I didn't want was for the characters to read like ambassadors for their identity, or to be almost performing their identity for a reader. So I needed to find a way to get deep inside. And it really varied with character. For example, the woman Samar, she's a middle-aged Palestinian academic. So we, based on that, have almost nothing in common. However, she feels very torn between what she feels as the imperative of her own work, her own research, and her obligations to her family. And she has a kind of conflicted relationship with her memories of her mother and how to match up those memories with the person that that she knows now as her mother, who is aging and has in so many ways softened. And I think a lot of what I've just described, a lot of these tensions and this relationship to memory and family, these are very much things that I share and concerns I share. So if I could start from, no matter how much of a sliver it was, the little places where our Venn diagrams overlapped, if I could start there, then I could wade away from myself into the character and sort of let go of myself and enter their world and their sensibility and their concerns more fully. And I know for me, perhaps I imagine for other fiction writers too, that is what I seek after, my own disappearance into someone else.
And you do it magnificently. I should say this is a kind of a point of view. I mean, even when it's written in the third person, it's really written in the first person, and a very close kind of first person.
Yes, yes. It's a very, very, very close third. Yes, it's interesting. I actually find with a close third, as I've written in, you can get closer, actually, than with an I. The I, for me, always, the pronoun I has a hard shell. And I'm working on something new now, and I'm writing in an I, and it's interesting how resistant that I is. But with a close third, you, the writer, are giving yourself permission to see things about the character that maybe the character is unwilling to see about themselves, or could see, but only for an instant. For example, the young mother, Emily, who at times feels a tremendous hostility towards her newborn, that sort of surfaces in her and she sees it and then almost immediately forgets about it, because how could you hold that thought in your conscious mind for too long? And so I think with a close third, it's actually, you have more of the characters, more of the sort of the darker corners of a character's internal world available to you than you do, or at least this is how I feel, with an I. But yeah, so I've heard the pronouns in terms of whether it's third or first don't matter, except to the writer. But I think for me, they make a huge difference in terms of what I feel is available to me as the writer in relation to whoever's point of view we're in.
Yeah, and I think you really made a point that I've never thought of before, and that is, you know, that it actually gives you more freedom to be closer to a character, to have this close third. And speaking of that, I think we should let our listeners in on, you know, the central fact at the heart of this book, which is two murders: the killing of an Israeli teenager, a young girl named Yael, and a Palestinian boy. They're both 14. His name is Salem. Tell us about those two murders and why you made this the heart of the book.
Yes. Actually, both of those two murders started as a kind of, there's a lot of violence that, there's the constant threat of violence or the constant reality of violence. And I think for a lot of the book, it's animating it as a kind of hum. There's a character, Miriam, who at one point notices that there's this sort of electric buzz all around her settlement. And she's not sure if it's the fence they put up for security or the power lines or something else. And I think violence is that kind of, that buzz always there, till it becomes a constant, a given, and in that way, almost invisible. And the both of those deaths actually started as a kind of background brutality that characterizes the novel and in my observations, the region. And it was really only as I began, I guess, pushing myself to write whatever I found the most frightening to write, that I began to deal more and more directly with these deaths and with the people who were affected by these deaths, and in some cases had participated in them. And that was a real sort of, I don't want to say challenge to myself because it makes it sound like an exercise, but more pushing myself to write into my own fear with the belief that that would yield a book with greater integrity. And I began to write, I suppose, into these deaths. The first time was actually just after the 2016 election, when Trump was elected. And I felt a profound agitation hearing about all the white women who had voted for Trump, white women like me. And I really wondered, you know, what is the difference between us? How many degrees of separation do we have? What is it? Is it just growing up in a household with more books or something? Like what made us different, me and these? And, you know, I did not vote for Trump, and I'm quite far left on the political spectrum, but I'm aware that in terms of how we've benefited and aided the status quo, perhaps we're not that different. And I think it was that sort of agitation and horror that pushed me to write from the perspective of a young Jewish Israeli man who lived on a settlement and who had, in a kind of incidental and unplanned way, participated in this brutal mob attack, a kind of randomly selected revenge target for Yael's murder, a young Palestinian man in a mall parking lot who was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, as they say. But I'd never gotten so close. I'd never gotten so close in my writing to ideological violence, to participating in it. And it's not as challenging, I would say, to write maybe violence. Writing violence is always challenging, but if the narrator is not participating in it, or if the writing itself is somehow commenting on the horror of this event, then at least you don't feel too at odds as the writer with what the narrator is saying or describing. You're sort of on the same page. You're on the same side, that violence is bad, essentially. However, when you're writing a character who perhaps felt that this violence was ideologically justified or enjoyed it or was excited by it, then suddenly you're in a position where the writing isn't commenting. The writing itself, sentence to sentence, isn't providing a moral judgment. And so that sort of safety was taken away from me as the writer. And there became a kind of messy blurriness between me, the writer, and the narrator who was remembering being an actor in this violence. And that was terrifying, I have to say. And how strange to spend, you know, my morning writing that. I was in grad school at the time, an MFA in creative writing, or in fiction writing, I should say, at UC Irvine. And then to emerge from my little dorm room bedroom and talk to my roommate about like whether or not we were going to buy a toaster oven. It was so strange and unsettling, but I think worth it, because in the same way that I felt the boundary between me and this young man blur, and that the writing itself wasn't providing me with an out by expressing some kind of horror or outrage, I think that effect translates to a reader who, I think, in reading that chapter, Salam Abu something, finds themselves implicated, that the writing itself isn't saying this a horrible thing happened, but is rather forcing the reader to contend with providing, I guess, the judgment and the moral engine, because the young man who's telling us about it doesn't feel bad at all. So I think those were the scariest and most intense chapters to write. But I also think that they pull the reader in. And by pull them in, I guess I mean implicate or almost force the hand of the reader in a way that to me felt critical.
Well, absolutely. And as one of those readers, I can tell you, you succeeded with that. I mean, you're referring to, I believe, Meir. Is that right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rebecca Sachs about her novel, City of a Thousand Gates. It follows the lives of a large cast of characters, Israelis and Palestinians, after the murders of two young teenagers, one Israeli, the other Palestinian. And what's interesting is that Meir himself, the fact that he was involved, he skirts around it and circles around it. Then he goes back to something else, and then he circles back around to that. And it's that process of, you know, approach avoidance, I think, that pulls the reader in even more and has you questioning, like, where is he at? Where's this character at? And therefore, where am I at? And then it becomes more clear. He's an elite athlete on a team, and there is another player on the team who's an Arab, Shibi. And before we talk about Shibi, just to continue with Meir for a moment, I found so interesting that he had a kind of fascination with Shibi, you know, and I wrote in my notes, the fascination with and brutality toward the people you are oppressing.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt there must be some, I guess, psychological works written on this or psychoanalytical, and I wish I had them handy, but the interplay between fascination and disgust are so alive to me, all over this novel, and certainly very much in the way that Meir looks at Palestinians. And there's a kind of a fascination and a disgust, and sometimes one disguised as the other. And I think for me, that felt to echo in the attitude maybe Israeli culture has towards Palestinian culture and the Arab world more generally. And this is echoed in everything from the disenfranchisement of Jews from the Arab world historically in Israel, Mizrahi Jews, and also the kind of articulation of Israeli culture, how often that is, it's hard to find the right word. I want to say borrowed from Palestinian culture, but you could also say appropriated, or you could say overlapped. It's every word you choose, of course, is reveals your ideology and your politics and whose narrative you're echoing. But at any rate, I found some of those larger dynamics, cultural dynamics between Israel and Palestine, kind of concentrated and literalized in the character of this young man, Meir. But yes, he's obsessed with Shibi a little. And it's hard not to feel that somehow animated his feelings towards the violence towards this unrelated young Palestinian boy. It's a relief, I suppose, that I, the writer, don't need to be able to offer perhaps a full psychological account for the character. I think of myself as someone who kind of specializes in consequences, but not diagnoses. On the level of psychology and the level of, you know, politics. I am obsessed with depicting the consequences of a boundary or an obsession, but I needn't be able to provide a full account of the obsession itself, which is great because I'm not fit to.
That's exactly what fiction does. I mean, you don't have to supply an account, you supply a character. And also, you don't shy away from very clear depiction. I mean, I have to say, to read this novel, Rebecca Sachs, City of a Thousand Gates, was for me to confront in such vivid detail the dehumanization of both peoples by the brutality of the Israeli state and society and an increasing brutality thereof. I just wonder, as a Jewish person yourself, how was that for you?
Well, it's been a trying process, I have to say. I moved to Israel in 2012, actually without very strong opinions about Israel. I went to do a Jewish studies master's, and I thought of myself as a sort of neutral, uninflected party, which is ridiculous, but that is how I imagined myself. And I think as I lived there, I was simultaneously becoming very attached to the Jewish state and to the belonging it afforded me and to the incredible warmth and hospitality with which I was received. And also feelings of deep horror at what it cost. What are the consequences of an ethnic democracy? And maybe forcing myself to witness them and articulating them to myself. So I sort of cultivated, I think, a sense of belonging and a sense of alienation simultaneously. Living in Israel made me a writer. It gave me a world of boundaries that were waiting to be depicted and tested in narrative. And it made me a Jew. You know, I grew up in a Reform household, but my mother wasn't born Jewish and never formally converted. And it was really only living in Israel and being sort of part of the rhythms of Jewish life that I ultimately decided to formally convert and embrace my Jewish identity. So Israel has given me so much, I have to say, and connected me to such profound parts of myself. And yet, at the same time, the consequences, again, this word consequences, but the consequences of preserving an ethnic democracy are horrific. And they are horrific for both the Palestinians who are subjugated and for the Israelis who are put into the role of oppressor. These consequences are not symmetrical in the least. One of the great narrative lies told again and again and again about the conflict is that it's somehow symmetrical. There's these two sides, these two ancient foes. And it's so obscene to present it that way when there is a staggering imbalance in power and money, and all of this is very much tied to legacies of colonialism and imperialism. So to reiterate, the consequences are not symmetrical or equivalent, but they are very real for both peoples. And in writing this, I tried to push myself to think deeply about what each character loves and what each character is giving up. And I think for me, this felt, if not truer, more heartfelt than perhaps a discussion of ideology or even politics explicitly. None of the characters are real political actors, but everyone has had their daily life shaped by the politics of the world they live in.
You have a character, Rebecca Sacks, in City of a Thousand Gates, Emily, who's an American. In fact, I saw two characters in which I thought I could discern the author of the book. It's Emily and also Vera, who's a journalist. But Emily, at one point, she goes on a visit, I think it is to the West Bank, you know, a kind of, this is a tour by an American Jewish man who is in sympathy with the Palestinian cause to show American Jews what it's like over there. And her voice comes through here. She says, you know, surely they, meaning people like her, are different than the wild-haired extremists who set fire to Palestinian schools, who take and take and take. That's not them. No, not them. Not them. No. And Was that your voice coming in there? I mean, how do you deal with, you know, it's so palpably in this book, one sees, you know, the taking of land and the blowing up of houses, the retribution, the denial of water in a time of climate change. It's just unending, the humiliations.
Yes, the characters of as you've noted, of Emily and Vera, who are the two white women in the novel, and so absolutely contain some elements of self-critique in them. There's no way around it. I don't know how much we share personally beyond our positionalities, but absolutely, that's an element. And yes, I mean, I think in that moment that you quoted, and I'm really glad you read that part aloud. Thank you. Where Emily is trying to convince herself that she's not a settler. She's different. She's different from settlers, from what Israelis call settlers. Most Palestinians, when they say settlers, they mean anyone who lives in Israel, not specifically individuals who live in, you know, parts of the West Bank where the UN considers the settlements illegal. These almost like academic distinctions that liberal Israelis and liberal Jews make between who's a settler and who's not are really for our own benefit and don't really have anything to do, as far as I can tell, with the discussions happening amongst Palestinians. But meaning for our benefit, I mean, to make us feel better, to draw these distinctions between extreme right politics and liberal politics. But of course, so often liberal politics are just right-wing politics apologetically or with more euphemism involved. So I would say that moment was, it's not a very ironic book. I don't traffic in a lot of irony, but I think that moment became maybe a little ironic. I really had Emily sort of protesting, oh no, not us, no, 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 which is a great way to signal to a reader like, hey, this person might be in a little bit of denial. You should you should think critically about what this person is saying here. And so, but yeah, I think I was interrogating more than anything my own desire to distinguish myself. This, you know, Jewish American Canadian woman who had come to Israel, who had taken citizenship, and yet, you know, I wanted to feel that I was different from the hardliner settlers, that I wasn't a settler, that I was on, in the parlance of our times, the right side of history. And I think denying myself the satisfaction of being one of the good guys was really important. And to recognize the ways in which these distinctions between who's a settler and who isn't a settler so often is, as I said, for the benefit of the ruling class, but really has very little to do with the lived reality of the individuals being subjugated. And so, yes, you're right to pick at that moment as a moment in which I think Emily and I share something. To go back to that, you know, what do I share with the character? We share something, and I did not want to shy away from it in that moment.
Yeah, and we only have a few minutes left, but I don't want to leave without exploring another very revealing part, because I think, you know, in this novel, you're not only getting into the minds of both Palestinians and Israelis, but also the minds of the rest of the world, and or the Western world in particular, and how we look upon the conflict. So there's an explosion in the novel, and we don't really know if the explosion is intentional or if it's an accident, but one of the characters takes a photo that they post to Instagram that goes to every screen on the planet. This photo comes to be known as the Palestinian girl and the Israeli soldier. Talk about that photo and, you know, what part that plays in this book. What are you showing us with that?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think the narratives that emerge about the conflict, about Palestine and Israel, especially from the West, I think these narratives so often, as I mentioned closer to the beginning of our conversation, so often traffic in this lie of symmetry. And I wanted to find a way to illustrate this lie, essentially, the narrative lie of a symmetrical conflict as a way to show the kind of addiction that the West has to resolution and to hope, and how this desire to see that need for resolution and hope gratified so often erases the individuals inside those moments and the deeply asymmetrical realities of these two people, of this young Israeli soldier and this young Palestinian student. And I hoped that in a way, I don't know, I wasn't thinking of this at the time, but I guess my hope would be that in a way it might, reading through this news story and the reader of the novel being privy to the realities of the lives of the characters in this news story might also, I don't know, I guess my hope would be perhaps lend itself to a little more criticism or awareness of how stories from Palestine and Israel are packaged.
Well, I wish we had longer to talk about this absolutely stunning novel, City of a Thousand Gates. It's so powerful. It's also so beautifully written. Thank you so much, Rebecca Sacks, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's been my honor. Thank you very much.
Rebecca Sacks. Read an excerpt from City of a Thousand Gates by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we revisit my 2016 interview with Palestinian-American novelist Susan Abulhawa. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Today, we're looking at fiction that illumines the conflict of Israel and Palestine, how the asymmetrical power between a dominant state and a subjugated people impacts the lives of all who live within the borders of the conflict. Earlier, we spoke with Rebecca Sacks about her novel, City of a Thousand Gates. Now, let's hear an extended excerpt from my 2016 interview with Susan Abulhawa about her novel of a Palestinian family, The Blue Between Sky and Water. What happens when a people are expelled from their homeland, from their homes where their families tilled the land for centuries, where their ancestors are buried, where they had hoped to build bright futures for their children? How do they retain their humanity in the face of such injustice? And how do they knit their lives and their families back together in spite of it? All these questions come vividly alive in Susan Abulhawa's novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. It's a powerful story about one Palestinian family that follows them from their idyllic village life in pre-Israel Palestine, expulsion in 1947, and through exile in Gaza and the U.S. Through it all runs the indomitable spirit of women, from the matriarch in Gaza, who holds the family together in the face of brutal occupation, to a young niece who returns to Palestine looking for her real home after a childhood spent in foster care in the U.S. Author Susan Abulhawa's first novel was the best-selling Mornings in Jenin. Now, in The Blue Between Sky and Water, she immerses the reader in the rich lives of the characters in a way that forever shreds the ugly stereotypes of Palestinians and Muslim women so current in the West. In addition to her writing, Susan Abulhawa also works with Playgrounds for Palestine, an organization she founded. Her parents were refugees of the 1967 war. Susan Abulhawa, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
The Blue Between Sky and Water is a story about the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in what became the State of Israel, and their lives under Israeli occupation. The story also takes place in the Gaza part of those occupied territories. But it's also the story of a family, and one particular family. Let's start with the family itself, just to introduce the characters. I think a lot of people think that Muslim women have no power, but the women in this story are its heart and soul. So tell us about them.
There are several women of different generations in the same family who dominate this narrative. The principal ones are Nazmiye. She's a matriarch in the family. She's kind of a wisecracker, manipulative, foul-mouthed, maternal, loving, sort of uninhibited in a lot of ways. And her word is the last word in the family in every way. And the other main character is Nur. She is Nazmiye's grandniece. And Nur grows up in the U.S. She's the woman in the family who kind of gets lost away. Her grandfather travels to the United States, and he passes away before they're able to return to Gaza, and she ends up growing up in foster care. So Nur, even though she, and this is explicitly stated in the story sometimes, she kind of grows up with everything that they want in Gaza, with opportunity, freedom to move about, to go anywhere in the world with this magical American passport, clean water, plenty of food, education, opportunity, etc. But somehow Nur is kind of the most broken one among them in a lot of ways, having grown up without family and sort of institutional care. It was an experience that kind of burrowed holes in her. And another character is Alwan. Alwan is Nazmiye's daughter, who you can imagine kind of growing up with such a forceful mother and with such a big presence. Alwan is a little bit more in the shadows. She's more reserved. But her waters run really deep, and she's a complicated character. She's pious and religious, but also a thinker too, and she questions a lot of the assumptions that were kind of handed down to her by society. And her daughter Rachel is the youngest of these women, and she's sort of the face of hope, or just kind of the future rather, and the person that they're all kind of investing themselves into, in a way. And there is one primary male character, Rachel's brother, Khaled, and he is, he's kind of the thread that binds everyone and binds previous generations and future generations, and his voice is kind of, it's an ethereal, kind of otherworldly voice. Because although he is flesh and blood, at least for a part of the narrative, Khaled goes into a kind of coma-like state called locked-in syndrome, and where he can perceive the world around him, but he cannot respond or interact with the world. So in other words, he can see, hear, feel, smell, everything, but he can't respond except by blinking his eyes or moving his diaphragm to breathe. And so in that sort of prison of his own body, Khaled finds his own freedom. He retreats into himself, and he's able to then transcend time, to transcend the physical world that those around him are bound by. So those are the characters. And it's interesting that you sort of brought up this stereotype of Muslim women. I did a couple of book tours recently for translations of the novel, and one of the comments that I got rather consistently, and so more than twice, was how surprised people were that the women, not only did they, sort of defy images or stereotypes of the passive, sort of subservient, quiet Muslim woman. But there is a surprise that the women could be so different from one another. And that was really, t- to me, that was more telling than anything about, you know, what the how the world sees us as Muslim women as being sort of almost uniform, necessarily similar. I don't think it would occur to anyone that, oh, wow, if the characters had all been white and Western, that, wow, they're so different from each other. How can that be? But and the fact that it, you know, it was such an immediate response or impression by some Western readers from this novel really kind of speaks to what the general perception is of Muslim Arab women and how we are supposed to be in the world.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, there aren't, you know, the West really isn't exposed to a lot of to Muslim women very much. It's not like they, you know, there are any television shows that show Muslim women, ordinary Muslim women, in any kind of, you know, any life situations, except as kind of victims of you know, crazy of a crazy world and or as passive. I mean, these are all, you know, the image that people have is the image that's perpetuated in popular culture, whether it be film, news media, or newspapers, broadcast media. If you think about what people in this country see, I mean, that's the stereotype. It's really not just for women, but also for men. I mean, when was the last time you saw a film with a loving Arab Muslim father in it, or you know, a comedian, an Arab comedian, or you know, people aren't interested in our lives in that way, except as we are relevant politically, or how we fit into sort of American foreign policy or something.
Yeah, especially at this time when the images of Muslims are, you know, such images that inspire hatred and are meant to inspire hatred. Those are the images that are being put out there. But let's go back to this wonderful book, because one of the things that I think it did is that it really does open this culture and the richness of Palestinian culture to the reader, and does so within the context of exile, really. You know, exile either into under occupation or even further on, as what happens with Noor. So let's go back to the beginning. It starts in 1948 in the village of Beit Daras. Is this a real village, by the way?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about that and, you know, what the life of the people are like there just in the moments before the Israeli, the Israeli army comes in and expels them quite brutally.
Well, Beit Daras, like most Palestinian villages were, especially rural ones, were mostly agricultural communities. Beit Daras had a beekeeping industry, hives. So yeah, the main industries in Beit Daras were agriculture and beekeeping. And the bit in there about the schools and when they were built and so forth, the classrooms and the collections to pay the teachers, that's actually real. I got that information from a dear friend of mine who wrote a book about Beit Daras. He's from Beit Daras. His name is Ramzi Baroud, and the book is called My Father Was a Freedom Fighter. So I was able to get a lot of information about Beit Daras. There's quite a history around it. And it was like all other towns. I mean, people were, they were busy with their lives. You know, it was a community, like many other communities in Palestine, that had lived under various rules under the Ottomans and then the British and many others before them for thousands of years. But it was really only the new Israeli conquest by principally European Jews that had settled in Palestine. It was that was the first conquest and occupation that really sought to eliminate Palestinians and remove them from their ancestral lands and replace them. So you can imagine it was the whole village was traumatized, and then this particular village was mostly pushed into Gaza, and a lot of the residents of Beit Taraf ended up in refugee camps there.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Susan Abulhawa about her terrific new novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. So now they go to Gaza, and on the way, I mean, during this whole terrible expulsion, there is an incredible incident with a, I don't even know how to pronounce it, djinn? Is that?
That's right, it's djinn.
Djinn. Okay, so
yeah, that's where the word genie comes from.
Right, and there are some pretty strong elements of magical realism in the story. I mean, you've already referred to Khaled, who does make an appearance in the beginning of the story in 1948, even though he's really not born until decades later. So, talk a little bit about why. Well, first, tell us what a djinn is, and what he does, what is this kind of appearance in the book and in the culture? And then why did you use these elements of magical realism in The Blue Between Sky and Water?
It's interesting that you're calling it magical realism, and others have done so too. But I actually didn't at any point set out to, I mean, there was never any point where I said, oh, I'm going to have elements of magical realism in here. And in fact, I didn't even think of it as such until you know, people started reviewing it. A djinn is, that's where the word genie comes from. It's they are otherworldly creatures, magical creatures, that most Muslims, especially Muslims in rural areas, believe in, because they are mentioned in the Quran, and the Quran sort of validates their presence in the world. So when I was growing up, my grandmother really believed in djinn, and so it was part of my childhood, at least. And, you know, like when I was naughty or something, or if she was mad at me, she would, you know, say something like djinn irkabek, or which means may a djinn possess you. and I was kind of terrified, you know, being possessed by a djinn. And then I, you know, as I sort of got a little bit older, I was thinking, oh, how cool it would be to have a djinn friend, and they could just make all my wishes come true, and it would be a good djinn. I mean, so these were, you know, it was just part of my childhood, and I had really strong memories of those thoughts and ruminations that went through my young, innocent mind. So it was, it felt natural and organic to have a character who was able to communicate with the djinn. And it's actually Nazmiya's mother. She was considered the village, you know, crazy woman. And so, you know, the djinn's name is Suleiman, and he mostly is in the beginning of the story, although he makes a couple of minor appearances here and there in other parts. But, you know, this element of the book is in many ways tangential. So it's, yeah, but it was an element that felt... it felt right. I don't really ever plan a novel. I don't plan the stories. I don't really know what's going to happen. I start with an idea or a seed, and then I kind of write for a long time, almost stream of consciousness, and then when I have volume, in other words, when I have lots of pages, I just kind of go back and start molding and rewriting and thinking about characters and getting to know them and just, you know, kind of letting their stories unfold organically. And that, you know, the djinn being in there was made perfect sense to me.
And he may be tangential, but Khaled is not. And
no.
He also, I mean, he goes back in time to teach Nazmiya's mother how to read. Nazmiya's sister how to read. That's right. Maryam, yes.
Mm-hmm.
She with the one brown eye and the one blue eye, as Noor also has. So, I mean, these are elements that I guess as a reader I had to see as symbolic of the larger story. is they just came out of your stream of consciousness, or is there something that you're saying of a more, you know, metaphorical meaning of this idea that time, the idea of time in the novel?
So the idea of time not being linear, or at least being perverted in some way, was also present in my previous novel, although perhaps, you know, not so obviously. And, you know, it's one of the things that I really like it when readers think about it and sort of explore on their own. For Palestinians, time in a lot of ways has become almost circular, or at least frozen in some ways. The generation that was exiled in 1948 never really left 1948. And, you know, they lived in these refugee camps, dreaming and imagining going home and holding on to their deeds and their keys and their life goal and their purpose. Their whole purpose in life was to return to their homes. And they kind of passed that longing onto the subsequent generations. And so there's a whole portion of Palestinian society that in a lot of ways hasn't been able to leave 1948. And there are actually concrete and political reasons for that, not just spiritual or emotional, psychological reasons. And likewise, you know, the same thing happened to those who were exiled in 1967. So there is kind of this, you know, when history is not redeemed for people, and, you know, you kind of end up living in this collective wound, whether you want to or not, because it becomes part of your identity in a way. So that's, you know, I suppose that's something, you know, readers can consider when it comes to the elements of time in this novel. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, Khaled being magical realism or not, his condition, what he does, I mean, I did leave it open for readers to consider that there were perhaps more conventional explanations for what was happening to him. You know, at one point, someone describes his condition, or his grandmother's condition, rather. Sorry, great-grandmother's condition as being schizophrenia. And, you know, being locked in one's body and one's mind can create all kinds of thoughts and that aren't real and so forth. So there, you know, for the logically minded among us, you know, it's open to that kind of interpretation, but it's also open to other interpretations that, you know, that actually this was real, that he did travel in time and all this really did happen exactly as it says it happened. So, you know, what's real is probably not the point.
Right. I want to go back to what you said about time in this, though. There's a really telling moment in the book where you write about the bombing of Gaza, and you write that Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. It's a powerful passage to read. Tell us, well, I mean, Israel has bombed Gaza quite a number of times, but I'm thinking this might have been, what, 2009? No, I'm not sure when was that one. But just that
2008, 2009. It was December 2008 into January 2009.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So you write that Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, people, you know, living amidst this incredible destruction should have put you in this immense kind of pause. Life has paused. The earth isn't spinning anymore. The sun is kind of stuck in the sky, and it's just beating down on you, and you know, there's nowhere to go, no, you know, what do, except try and salvage. And I think these kinds of situations are so profound and so heavy and so dense and so laden with things that are incomprehensible to those of us who don't live these moments, that, yeah, it's powerful enough to make day into night and night into day and just stop stop the earth spin as far as you're concerned.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with Susan Abulhawa about her novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. So our listeners know a little bit, I found the passage. I'm going to read a little bit from it, if it's okay with you, just the first paragraph of that chapter. Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. As if time had been wounded, it now moved in a crawl, its daily passage impeded by the rubble that carpeted the terrain, its presence so thick that Hajja Nazmiya felt the sun dragging along the heavy weight of each hour. So much needed to be done, yet there was nothing to do. People gathered with nothing to say. Even when they spoke, their words were coated in a silence that stared into a chasm as they picked out and buried their dead. Even rage and calls for revenge seemed perfunctory. Tears made for a sort of refuge, a place to go to feel something in a wreckage that demanded numbness. For many, it was simply a waiting to die. Hope seemed vulgar in this hour, and the idea of death was so comforting and alluring that no one spoke, lest words do away with the seduction of a quiet ending. That was a passage from Susan Abulhawa's novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. And that's all we have time for today. We played an extended excerpt from our 2016 interview with Abulhawa. Listen to the rest at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.